Morning.
Morning.
Glad to see you all safely here. We have two cases today, and the first is 08AP1204CR, State versus Pinkard. And arguing on behalf of Mr. Pinkard is Attorney Richard L. Safiro. You may proceed, counsel.
Justices, good morning. The starting point, of course, for this discussion is the Fourth Amendment. It's the rule. The rule has to be followed except in the event of a specifically established, well-delineated exception being found and demonstrated. And in this case, one such exception is argued, that being the community caretaker exception. That's the heart of the case today. Standard of review, we're not challenging the facts that were found below us. We're not dealing with a clear error situation, but we are talking about the application of those facts to the constitutional law. That, of course, frees you to review this, and in any event, as the highest court in the state, that's your job. The community caretaker exception, of course, comes from the U.S. Supreme Court 73 decision in Cady versus Dombrowski, which is an automobile exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement. Since 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court has never seen fit to extend this exception beyond the automobile case. And for me, I would argue on behalf of Mr. Pinker, that should be the beginning and the end of this, because this is not an automobile, this is somebody's home. Different rules apply for homes. Different expectations of privacy exist for homes than what you have present in the case of a car. And there's good reasons for that. And I've cited them in my brief.
Counsel, if we accept that argument, do we have to overturn Bees in 77 and the subsequent cases in winding up with Kramer of last term?
Kramer was an automobile case, although I think the direction that Kramer went, if you're accepting that automobile is just one part of a balancing test, then I think you haven't gone far enough, because in fact community caretaker is an automobile exception. And while it's not germane to Kramer itself, because it was an automobile case, certainly in this or any other case involving a home search, it's on point. We're dealing with a home search here.
Well, but Kramer relies on cases that aren't home that aren't auto cases in Wisconsin.
Well, and to the extent that there are arguably, if not actually, community caretaker home search cases in Wisconsin, that puts Wisconsin at odds with a number of federal circuits, and I would say with the U.S. Supreme Court itself. And so to answer your question, yes, I think you would. However, certainly, at some point, if this court follows my argument on Cady and says, you know what, this is a home case, therefore it doesn't apply, case reversed, that's the end of it. But if this court goes on to say, we're going to extend that caretaker exception to searches of homes, now I think we've got a situation where we're all in federal court. And at that point, we'll ultimately get the decision, presumably at a higher level as to what the U.S. Constitution means, because certainly we can decide this case on the basis of the Wisconsin Constitution alone, but for the fact that it is viewed identical in this context to the Fourth Amendment. And so really, I think what this court's jurisprudence has done on all but one limited exception unapplicable here is it has followed the U.S. Supreme Court on Fourth Amendment issues. And on this Fourth Amendment issue, there only is an auto exception. There is not a home exception. And that was why, it was really one of the reasons why I cited the Pisciani case in my reply brief. Usually when I quote a case, it's for a paragraph. As you'll recall, I ran on for almost two pages because I wanted to make sure that the point was made that at least the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals says this is an auto case, as do several other federal circuits. They say this is an auto exception, not a home exception.
Counsel, if I'm correct, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided Cady, They did indeed draw distinctions between automobiles and residences, but they never said, at least my reading of the case, they never said this can never be applied to a residence. They drew the distinctions, but they certainly didn't prohibit application of the doctrine to a residence. So why should we overrule the jurisprudence in Wisconsin because perhaps that's the way it will go in the future?
They didn't prohibit it, but if you look at their reasoning, the reasoning is all based on the auto exception. Why do we have an auto exception? And they cited all the reasons why we have it, and it was on that basis that they created this community caretaker exception. In effect, that's the traditional case, like Kramer itself, driving in on the icy roads this morning, I saw a guy who slid in the ditch. Perfect example for a community caretaker case. The police can certainly go to that guy's car in the ditch and check him out, see if he's all right. But that's different than coming into somebody's house at 9 o'clock in the morning on a tip that he's sleeping. It's very different. And in any event, without even getting to those merits, I guess in answer to your question, the reasoning of the court was entirely based on auto exception.
Stand.
I'm sorry, apologies. I'll stay put. I get happy feet. I'll stay put.
Otherwise, we'll have to handcuff you.
Yes, ma'am.
We want your words recorded for all time.
Let me go further if I...
Justice Crooks.
Yeah, I'd like to go further if I might with what we were discussing. In Kramer, the point was made by this court that one of the factors in the balancing test is indeed whether or not it's an automobile situation or a residential situation. So certainly this court has been aware of the distinction. And I'm just having trouble understanding why at this point we should start overruling our cases based on what was really not decided in Katie.
At the risk of repeating myself, which I guess is a risk I'll take, Katie's reasoning was all based on the auto exception on the one hand. On the other hand, this court in Kramer made that merely one factor. Now, ultimately, it'll be up to the U.S. Supreme Court whether your decision in Kramer is correct or whether my argument is correct. Ultimately, I'd imagine whoever loses here may very well take it up into the federal system. But this is a situation, I think, because that's the reasoning relied upon by Katie, that we really don't dare go beyond that reasoning. That would at least be my take on how to address Katie to the facts of this case.
I'm always kind of interested. If you don't want to acknowledge the community caretaker exception here, what should the police have done when they got this call? When Officer Lopez received this call, what do you think should have happened?
Well, let's look at what the call was. And that's the best starting point, is the facts. Anonymous, fleshless telephone caller, no idea whether he's reliable or anything, says, Big Boy and Amelia are upstairs sleeping next to cocaine, cash, and drugs. And by the way, the door is 3/4 of the way open. Now, how might this tipster know this? Might this tipster not have just been in that very bedroom, have walked out that very door, and himself left it open? To me, I think that's one rational view of the facts. But in any event, the only thing that even comes close to community caretaker is, I believe he used the word concern. There's drugs and cash and scales, and I have concern. What was his concern? Was he concerned that there's a drug house in the neighborhood? Was he concerned for health? If he had just been in that bedroom, might he not have been able to say, they're unconscious, or they're bleeding, or they're not breathing, the kinds of things that would give you emergency aid exception grounds to go in there and render emergency aid under that exception, which was waived, and in fact, in this case, I think the state concedes, doesn't apply. No, what you have here is nothing more than concern, and essentially, Officer Rosowski, quoted by the trial court in this decision as saying, sounded like a drug house to him. If you truly believe that this is somebody who has been injured or ill, what do? You call the paramedics or to call the intelligence division gang squad and bring 5 uniformed armed officers in to the building? Those are the objective facts. That's what happened here, and it really is an objective test. Subjectively, he's testified that he thought maybe somebody's welfare was at issue here. But objectively, we know that phone call, we know that open door, we know that they sent five uniformed armed officers in there and that they went in. Normally what happens when you get a drug house tip, you'll set up a controlled buy, you'll do something. Or, let's look at Kramer again, let's look at the balancing test. What were the alternatives? Pinker lived in a three-family building. The three-family building might have had two other families living in it. Might we not knock on their doors and ask, anything seem weird to you, anything up? Pinkard, as I recall, has a record, a prior arrest record, which I'm sure was easily accessible to the police on their squad computer. Let's get his phone number and call. Let's call and see, is everything all right? I think it was a Ferguson case where they knocked 30 to 45 minutes. Here, 30 to 45 seconds, and then they go up. Somebody is said to be sleeping. Not said to be hurt, said to be sleeping. On the facts of this case, I don't think you can go any farther, really, than in any case, you can't go any farther than the Fourth Amendment lets you. The Fourth Amendment does not let you come into somebody's house because you get a call that they're sleeping, even if they're sleeping next to drugs and scales and guns. If you do that, here's what you're saying. If you do that, here's what you're saying. You're saying that every time you get a call about a drug house, because drugs are dangerous, because somebody might have overdosed or might have taken bad drugs, Fourth Amendment's out the window. Now you just go right on in, community caretaker, to check on their safety. There isn't any more Fourth Amendment protection for alleged drug house situations. So I have kind of a roundabout answer, but I guess that's how I would answer your question. I don't know if I answered it all.
Was this a 911 call?
No, it was not. This was an anonymous tip.
Was this a call directly to Officer Lopez or to the police department?
I don't know that the record is clear on that point, but at some point Officer Lopez says, I can't handle the call, and so Officer Ozowski handles it, not in the sense of, well, let's go check and see if somebody's hurt, like, for instance, in the LaFournier case, an emergency aid case, where you get a call about somebody who's overdosed on drugs, you go up there, you check it out, and then you try to find out what substance they took, and you're looking around the room, what did she take? Because you want to render emergency aid. No, this is a case where he's handling the complaint, not somebody in need, but the complaint. The complaint essentially was that of a drug house, and he's checking out the drug house.
How did it get from the first officer, from Gomez, to the second officer? Is it anything in the record that indicates that because it was a drug house complaint, it goes to the drug unit? This guy was in a particular unit and division in the police department.
Correct. Ozowski was in the intelligence division gang squad. Traditionally, the intelligence division gang squad is not in the business of rendering medical aid. There's paramedics for that. I don't know, because I don't think the record is clear as to how or why Lopez gets Ozowski with the gang squad involved. But basically, I think the reasonable inference is, since he's checking out the complaint, that's where drug complaints are handled.
Well, that's where my next question was. Is there another unit for drug houses or drug complaints?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Is there another unit in the police department for drug houses, drug complaints, or is this the drug? Is the gang unit the drug unit, too?
I don't know.
Or isn't it in the record?
Sure, and it's not. I don't think it is in the record, and I don't profess to know what the Milwaukee Police Department's all their ins and outs are. I know the sheriff has a special drug enforcement division. The police may, too, but since drugs and gangs often go hand in hand, it wouldn't be surprising to have the gang squad check out a drug complaint.
Counsel, if we start applying Kramer and looking at the totality of the circumstances, don't you think it's significant that when the police announce themselves at the three-quarters open door and wait 30 to 45 seconds and nobody responds, and then they go to the bedroom door, they again announce themselves, they wait and nobody responds, and ultimately the way they have to wake up Pinkard is by shaking him awake. Aren't all of those factors that would seem to justify a community caretaker approach?
No. Respectfully, no. I don't think sleep is the kind of thing the community caretaker is meant to address. And as I said earlier, the only way this tipster would know what he knew would have been if he would have been in the room with them. And nothing in that tip, nothing other than the use of the word concern, even hints at any reason to fear for these people's welfare. The fact that people in a deep sleep, I don't know whether they were out until all hours or what their deal was, why they're in such a deep sleep at 9 o'clock in the morning. You and I are all up and at work. But for whatever reason, not everybody wakes up all that great out of a deep sleep. And these people apparently are among that class of folks. And 30 to 45 seconds, I mean, I don't know that if I'm in a deep sleep, somebody shouting at me is going to make me answer, yes, yes, what is it? You know, very quickly, more happen, as you said. Not only that, but then they're at the bedroom door. It's not real clear from the record, again, whether they shouted police in the bedroom or said police or what the decibel level was. But at some point, they say police, and they shake him, and he wakes up. But there's never been anything produced in the record to give any indication that anybody had any reason to fear, objectively, fear for health or safety.
Counselor, what if when he went into the bedroom and shook Mr. Pinkert, he didn't rouse him because he'd taken too many drugs and he was overdosed? And then the police called for assistance, medical assistance, who came and aided him, took him to the hospital or whatever, and gave him whatever treatment was needed to help with his overdosed condition. Is there still a Fourth Amendment violation?
Yes, because we're actually a few steps down the road from where the Fourth Amendment starts. The Fourth Amendment starts at the doorway.
So it doesn't matter to you whether the guy is overdosed or not. You just think they can't even check on that.
Oh, no, and as a human being, of course it does.
No, I didn't mean to throw that kind of a stone. Sure. I'm looking at the Fourth Amendment.
Right, and in fact, and that's where I'm coming from, too.
Yeah.
Fourth Amendment starts at that downstairs, actually at that front door, the door that's open. Do they have the right to go in, or don't they? And certainly, you can say that really in any drug case. If the police get a tip that there's a drug house, nobody even uses the word concern, but they walk into the house, and lo and behold, somebody's passed out. Well, thank God they're there to save their life, but
yes,
they still violated the Fourth.
No, but that, I want to look at the facts of this case.
Right.
The only fact I want to change is that, in fact, he had taken an overdose of cocaine and needed some assistance in order not to be in difficulties. And if I hear what you're saying, is that doesn't make any difference.
He had no right to be there, right. That's
okay.
True.
All right. Hindsight doesn't give you the authority under the Fourth Amendment.
Correct. You need objectively articulable facts. You need objective facts. And again, what do we have? We have a phone call, we have an open door, and that's it. That's what we have for objective facts. And that's what they used to go in on. And I understand that Kramer, and I think correctly so, spoke about the totally divorced language in Katie, how it's not a requirement so much as it is an observation. But the observation here, I think, is one of the police checking out a drug house with nothing more than the word concern about sleeping people to go on.
So
it's not enough.
Counsel, if I understand your argument, even if law enforcement received a call saying these people are upstairs, they're bleeding, they're dying, you've got to go help them, there's still no community caretaker. That's still a Fourth Amendment violation, and they have no obligation, right, or responsibility to go into that home. Their job is to maybe call an ambulance or refer it to someone else at the most, and maybe not even that.
That's a different scenario. That, I think, what you just said, I would say falls under the emergency aid exception, because now you have an immediate medical emergency that needs to be addressed. You actually have a call saying so. You don't have that here.
But my question was, you're saying community caretaker would never fit.
Correct, because it only deals with cars. Emergency aid would let them go in to the home under your scenario.
Okay.
They still can go in.
But something less than that would not fit emergency aid, and they ought to ignore the call. Because, you know, part of what we're going to do here is law enforcement just wants to know what they can and what they can't do. And so that's part of our job, to let them know, okay, let's make it clear for you what you can and cannot do so they know how to do it right in the future. So the rule should be, if they get a call like this, ignore it?
No, the rule should be, if they get a call just like this, where the only thing is that someone's sleeping next to drugs and cash and I have concern, the thing to do at that point is, one, what they always do, they could go the route of setting up a controlled by a later date, which is what usually happens, or two, I guess I'm not seeing any cause in this tip to check it out. I have concern, says the fleshless telephone. I have concern. We don't even know what that means. It's ambiguous. I'm concerned that there's a drug house down the block, or I'm concerned about what? I don't know.
Is there
enough here to get a warrant?
No.
They can't investigate, even if they think this is just a drug house, they can't do anything about it?
Not on these facts, and I'm sure this happens all the time, that Joe down the block calls and says, I think they're selling drugs out of that house. Is that probable cause to go in? No. But now that you've got the tip, now you start investigating. Maybe you watch the house closer. Maybe you surveil the place. Maybe you set up controlled buys, whatever. But no, on these facts, you really haven't enough.
Counsel, I would thank you. I would like to ask a follow-up, a corollary to Justice Eagler's question. Change the hypothetical posed in that question from the occupants of the house are bleeding to the call saying, gee, there's a bunch of drugs on the nightstand next to the bed, and the occupants of the house are unconscious. I don't know if they're in cardiac arrest. I don't know if their respiratory system is failing because they've taken too many drugs. Under the rule that you are proposing that we articulate as a result of this case, would that be enough for an emergency exception?
Yes, but not community caretaker, but emergency aid, yes.
And it's not exigent circumstances because you don't have the probable cause.
Correct. You haven't got probable cause to do traditional police work in that scenario, to get a warrant.
Doesn't that put a remarkable amount of weight on how the caller chooses to characterize the conditions and the state of the individual, the occupants of the house? I mean, for instance, to an average layperson, I suppose it might be challenging to figure out whether an unconscious person is sleeping or passed out because of some kind of outside influence. Is your argument putting a little too much weight on how the caller chooses to characterize what could be a medical condition?
Well, the starting point always is, as I said, the Fourth Amendment says you got to get a warrant unless there is an exception. That's the starting point. Now, one of the things that's always to be viewed, and I see my warning light is on, one of the things that's always to be viewed is what are the objective known facts? And as an officer, you're only left with what you either see or what you hear. And if all you hear from the tipster is sleeping people, I have concern, that's not enough for a medical emergency.
Well, okay, so the police then under your, what you're saying, the police then would be bound by how the caller characterizes the physical condition of the occupants.
They're bound on the totality of the circumstances by the objective facts, and that's one of the objective facts of what they're told. And so I guess in that sense, yes.
Did the gang crimes unit know who Big Boy was?
Again, I'm not recalling whether the record is clear on that, but I do know for a fact that the Milwaukee police reference people by street names, correlating those to their personal names, and so chances are they probably did know who Big Boy was.
Would that have made a difference in getting a warrant?
Well, on the totality of circumstances, if they know that Big Boy is Pinkard and that Pinkard has a drug record, that certainly would be one factor. But the fact that he's been a dealer before doesn't mean that he's a dealer now. Maybe he's cleaned up his act, so he needs something more, perhaps, to get that probable cause for a warrant.
Counsel, you've several times said use the phrase, the caller indicated the people were sleeping, drugs around, and I have concern. Where does that comment come from? I'm looking at the transcript, and I've looked at it and looked at it, and I don't see it. Does it mean?
I have a query because I actually bothered to correlate this stuff yesterday. Apologies if this takes a little bit of time.
Well, let me.
I've got my, like, in my brief at pages 2 and 3 and 4, I cite those record facts. If you want, I can be specific right now, or I can just point to the pages 2 through 4 of my brief.
Yeah, brief, I don't want to say it's not good enough, but I want to know the source of the information, and I just can't find
again,
it.
You know, at,
you're going to be sitting down for a bit, or I might take the opportunity to ask your opposing
right, because my red light is on now, so I can either answer you now or I can go sit down.
What exactly are you looking for? The word's concern?
Yes, because when
that's the word that's
when the officer, when Officer Osowski testifies as to what he was told on page 13 and 14 of the transcript, he testifies that he was only told by Lopez that they were sleeping, there appeared to be cocaine. The cross-examination is did Lopez tell you about a medical condition? They needed some medical care? And the answer is no. Did he tell you that he feared something was happening inside the residence that might jeopardize the safety? Osowski says no. The question is, he actually indicated to you it's basically a drug investigation, that people are sound asleep and there's drugs and scales and guns in there, right? The answer was he did not say that, no. Question, well, your report indicates that, in fact, that's why you went in there, is because they appeared to be cocaine, money, and scales there. The answer is that's correct. It appeared to be, sounded like a drug house to me. And then finally, the officer Lopez did not indicate to you that there was some emergency with regard to the people at the residence themselves that needed some type of medical attention or in some need of the police department rescuing them, did he? And the answer is no. And so when I looked at this and I looked at it and looked at it, I can't find it unless it's in the report, and I don't see the reports in the report.
And I'll need to look for it again because I found it referenced in paragraph 5 of the appellate court decision where they're quoting from Officer Osowski's testimony. They actually talk about concern.
Your brief at page 5 says neither of these reports express any concern for the safety or welfare of the home's occupants. So that is Osowski's report. Supplemental report on March 14th.
Correct, and that was why I attached them to the post-conviction motion, was because they didn't express that specific concern, and nor was specific concern expressed at all. It just, I think, the use of the word concern by the tipster.
Well, you, at least as to those two motions, nothing is said about concern. So I'd suggest that you try and find that. We'll
bring my downtime. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
James M. Freimuth, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Freimuth.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state as respondent in this criminal case. The state asked this court to hold that police lawfully seized in plain view the drug-related evidence at issue after police lawfully entered Defendant Pinkard's residence under the community caretaker exception to the warrant requirement. The state asked this court in doing so to reach four conclusions. First, the community caretaker exception applies to a warrantless entry to a residence. Second, police in this case were engaged in bona fide community caretaker activity in entering Pinkard's residence, namely, to ensure the welfare of occupants who reportedly were asleep amidst cocaine and money with the back door to the residence wide open and who were unresponsive to a police knock and announce on the open, heavy aluminum door. The trial court expressly found that, quote, the purpose that the police were there was, in essence, to inquire as to the health and safety of the occupants, unquote. Third, the public need and interest in making the entry outweighed the intrusion on Pinkard's privacy, which already was compromised by the fact of the open door. The entry, which occurred after 9 a.m. on a midsummer morning, was objectively reasonable to ensure that no occupant was in distress from a drug overdose or had been victimized by a crime, and that no new or additional harm would accrue from the prospect of a third party entering the residence. And fourth, to complete the analysis, the drug evidence found in Pinkard's bedroom was lawfully seized under the plain view doctrine. Turning then to the threshold matter, this court should conclude, in accordance with prior Wisconsin case law, that the community caretaker exception applies to warrantless entries to residential premises. Such application is both necessary and appropriate to ensure that police can assist persons who may be in need, even if police lack sufficient information that a physical injury has occurred or is being threatened. In this case, Pinkard never disputed application of the caretaker exception to residences until his reply brief in this court. The state, therefore, hasn't really developed that aspect of this case beyond what it set forth sort of summarily in its brief. I would suggest that there is a recent case that I will submit a supplemental authority on out of South Dakota that is tries to pull together all the case law in this area, including recognizing the split among the federal circuits. That case is State versus Denui, that's D-E-N-E-U-I, at 775 Northwest 2nd, 221, that's South Dakota Supreme Court, issued in November of 2009. In Wisconsin, at least three published decisions of the Court of Appeals have applied the caretaker exception to residential premises. They're discussed in the state's brief. In particular, State versus Zedonis is very close on the facts to this case, or probably closest among the cases. And there's State versus Ferguson and State versus Horngren. This court, in a 1977 case, Bees, also discussed at least that application of that caretaker exception to a residential garage situation, although it's slightly different because there was no entry actually into that garage. There was an open door through which the officer saw.
You can argue it was curtilage in that case. They didn't, I mean, it didn't come up, but you can argue that that whole area in which they entered was curtilage.
Right.
I don't remember. It could have been a public alley. I just don't remember that. But if
right,
it was, weren't a public alley, it could have been curtilage.
It was an alley. There was it was a noise complaint. He went up to the garage.
So it's a public alley. You didn't really enter curtilage. You were on
at that
public
point,
property.
Right.
Yeah.
He did get to the threshold of the garage door, I understand, and that's where he saw the.
It was open, and he saw wires
right.
that had been stolen.
Many courts, as the South Dakota case outlines, have extended the caretaker exception to residential entries in situations that don't involve actual or threatened physical harm to a person. For example, water leaking from above into apartments below, or an excessive noise complaint, or a noxious odor, a gaseous odor. So there are those circumstances. In fact, there may be a myriad ambiguous residential situations like this case, in which the police have reason to be concerned about the welfare of possible occupants, even though they lack more specific information about an actual or threatened physical injury.
Mr. Frymuth, what's the emergency exception, which is different from exigent circumstances?
That's there. Right. The emergency exception has both a subjective, like this community caretaker, and objective prong. The subjective is that the officer must be motivated by need to render aid, or immediate need to render aid. And the objective part is that a reasonable person in that officer's position would believe both that there was an immediate need to aid someone due to, and this is the key difference between this, I think, and the community care.
That was my next question.
Due to actual or threatened injury is the language from the Boges case. And then that a reasonable person would believe that immediate entry was necessary to provide that aid. I think what...
Why here wouldn't this fit? I mean, if the officer is subjectively and objectively concerned about whether there was an overdose, why wouldn't that fit of rendering aid due to actual injury, threatened injury, not because someone's actually making a threat now, but leaving it go might be a threat.
Right. I think it's a close call. I didn't argue it. It wasn't argued below because there was no report, for example, that anyone was unconscious or not breathing, that type of scenario. I think what you have here are three crucial facts, any of which, if they weren't present, might not allow the community caretaker to apply. Those three facts are a report of people asleep amidst cocaine in plain view, amidst cocaine, and then critically the open door, open exterior door. And actually, I'm sorry, a fourth fact, if you will, and that is when the police arrive and confirm the open door and then knock on it and wait 30 to 45 seconds and no one responds. And if there are two occupants, you would expect maybe one of them at least to have heard that knock. Those are critical facts here. I think that if you removed any of those, you might not have a community caretaker application.
Well, if you have these four factors, why isn't it an emergency aid exception?
I guess, I mean, if this court so found, I would take it. I just have, I guess, some difficulty where you don't have specific, like I said, unconscious, a report of unconscious. I would suggest, however, that when somebody, a caller, is saying, well, they appear to be asleep, which was the language in the that was used, that doesn't necessarily preclude the possibility where there's drugs involved that there was an overdose or that they may lapse into a state that is unconscious and not breathing and needs immediate medical help. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, as was pointed out in the initial argument, the fact that there was no injury here or whether there had been an injury wouldn't necessarily matter or does not matter to the Fourth Amendment analysis. However, I think a key question here is, would the officers have been derelict in their duty if they hadn't at least investigated to see whether these were people in need, whether there had been a burglary or a crime committed, whether this is drugs that a child wandering about could come in and think it's sugar or something.
What does the fact that five police officers tell you about objectively?
Right. The record isn't clear how all five came to be, other than I think there was in the police report from the officer who testified, he said when he arrived there, he contacted and called for the other four to come. And I think because if this is a drug scenario, you don't know what you might encounter in that residence. I think the words he used were we need to make an entry and a protective sweep for the welfare of the people, of the reported occupants. But he was part of the gang unit, which, as I understand, and from the transcript, he describes it as including narcotics investigation. So I think the fact that the tip related to that and he didn't know what he had is why that many officers were involved in going in.
Counsel, I'm interested in your opinion as to the material distinctions, if any, between the facts of the present case and the facts as outlined in Zadonis, although the incident occurred as a result of some basically wild dogs barking outside the house. It involved, it seems to me, on page 837 of that case, the police entry into a residence after there was no response from the occupants of the house after a fairly substantial period of time where the police were trying to get the attention of the occupants. What distinctions do you see between the material points of this case and Zadonis?
The efforts of the police to rouse the occupants in Zadonis were more substantial, I think, than in this case. At least the record would suggest, as you indicated. I believe they used bullhorns or air horns or something to try to, as well as then knocking and trying to contact any occupants.
And the fact, perhaps, that their entrance was hindered, shall we say, by three wild Rottweilers standing in between them and the house.
Right. Here, you don't have more information other than that they knocked, announced their presence, waited 30 to 45 seconds. I think the fact that this is a heavy aluminum door, presumably a loud knock, I mean, it's not developed in the record, I think the open door is actually symbolically also an entree for them to use the community caretaker, in the sense that it's like the hazard lights on an automobile. It's a suggestion that something is amiss here when you have this door wide open, especially if there are people who are in a state of either asleep or whatever their condition might be, amid drugs out in the open. So I think this is right at that crux of, like I said, where you need each of these factors for that to occur. In Zadonis, I think it was maybe a little bit easier because they had more effort, at least, made to
the length contact. The length of time, perhaps.
Right. Other than that, I don't see a distinction of significance, I think, for Fourth Amendment purposes.
Counsel, with Justice Foster's assistance, I was able to locate the concerned comment in the transcript. And so you have that comment that Osowski apparently was told by Lopez, people sleeping, drugs, and he was concerned. Lopez, according to the transcript, calls Osowski on his cell phone. Osowski is part of the drug unit. Four or five officers respond. Osowski testifies that, I don't want to take time to get the exact words, but in essence he testified he went there because he thought it was a drug house. So all of that suggests to me that he went there because, as he testified, it was a drug house. Brings five with him. I don't know why Lopez, and it's not clear from the transcript, Lopez wouldn't have just had, you know, the police department handle this, why he calls Osowski on Osowski's cell phone. To me, there's an inference he does it because it's Osowski's part of that unit. Well, it's an inference. I don't know if it's right. So with all of that, how does that transform, and knowing that you can have part of the equation be, you know, he's in there to do law enforcement in addition to community caretaking, but how can that be in a balance? It seems like, whoops, that drug enforcement was much higher in the totality of circumstances because he wasn't told about any fear for emergency or medical situation. He specifically testified to that. So tell me about that balance. It seems to me that I'm doing a drug investigation is much higher than I'm concerned about something.
In Kramer, of course, this court addressed what that test is going to be for
yes.
community caretaker. And unlike Fourth Amendment searches where you've got a warrantless exception like this, subjective motivation of the officer is part of the analysis as well
right.
as objective. Here, the officer, I think, forthrightly acknowledged that, and I think his words were, quote, sounded like a drug house. He also testified, however, and I think his conduct bears this out, that what he didn't just barge in and I think the reason, let me backtrack just a little, I think the reason he was contacted by Officer Lopez, presumably, is because this did sound like a drug house, and it was a concern that somebody with that kind of background should be the person to investigate rather than somebody, for example, a beat officer that might not know what he's encountering. But when he gets to the premises, he doesn't just barge in. He does knock on the door. He does express concern for the well-being based on what he knows now and what he sees at the scene. And this is a fluid situation. I mean, we don't have a nice picture or a TV view where we can see what was going on when this happened. But I think when you've got, and this is again why this is on the fringe, you've got concerns that are both law enforcement and public health and safety. And I think in that balance, I don't know where you can say primary versus secondary other than that his conduct was objectively reasonable and appropriate to exercise that health and safety concern that he was concerned about.
Do you know anything about why Officer Lopez is the one who got the call?
The record doesn't indicate. I believe the record says only that the call came to him personally. The suggestion is that the person, the caller, who the Officer Lopez said didn't want to be identified, knew Officer Lopez. Why he knew him is not in the record. That's all that the record says about that.
I mean, on his cell phone?
I don't even know if the record says cell phone. But I think that also goes to why I have trouble with the emergency doctrine here, and that is that Officer Lopez said, well, I'm busy, can you take this call? And he refers it to somebody in the intelligence unit that's also the narcotics investigation unit. Doesn't mean that there's not concern, but it's just that that's how this played out, given how it happened.
The question was asked whether the police could have obtained a warrant on this information.
I didn't think there was enough probable cause based on what they confirmed, the tip of the open door. Whether they knew who was inside isn't in the record either. They may have, if these are drug officers and if Pinkert has a drug history, might know him, but would they know that he's at this address? They were told Big Baby. Would they know that nickname? It's not in the record. If they knew that nickname, and with the open door and the report of drugs, maybe you could get a warrant. I just don't know. But I think they acted reasonably here, not just out of concern for the law enforcement aspect of this, but for the welfare of the occupants, and that to make sure that somebody who, you know, is reported to be sleeping amidst drugs in this open setting here is pretty concerning.
Mr.
Page 17 of your brief, you say, respectfully, the state harbors doubt whether the anonymous tip in the present case satisfies probable cause of illegal drug dealing, even though you have the corroboration of the open door.
Right.
In any event, you say it might also satisfy the narrower emergency doctrine.
Yes, I had trouble deciding how much to say about that, but I didn't want to close the door, if you will, completely to it, although, as I explained, I have a hard time fitting this into the emergency doctrine.
You don't need the probable cause for the emergency doctrine.
No, right. It's an exception to the law.
Okay,
warrant,
and
right.
That's so your brief is consistent with your saying probably, although you would take our finding of probable cause, too.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think when you start applying the community caretaker to residences, or when you it sort of reads out the emergency doctrine. Every emergency doctrine case is going to be a community caretaker case, but not the reverse. I mean, certainly if you've got a true emergency, that's a much easier case to see. This is one that's right on that cusp, if you will. I'm sorry.
Well, you put a lot of emphasis on the 45-second knock and announce. Didn't they have to do that under Wisconsin law?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
In
the search and seizure cases, you mean the knock and announce?
Huh?
I don't know the precise number of seconds.
There would have been a knock and announce here. They didn't have to worry about if they're sleeping people. They didn't have to worry about them getting rid of the drugs or getting the arms.
No, right.
So this was, in a regular drug bust, they would have knocked and announced.
Right.
I'm just trying to figure out all these factors that play a role here.
Right.
Here's what bothers me, Mr. Primus.
Yes.
What drug bust, what a tip that it's a drug house wouldn't fit the community caretaker function? You have to have the open door. Is that important? Why? Concerned that a kid was going to get there. No one expressed concern.
They didn't explain.
No one said that.
Right.
No one said it at any of the proceedings, so that's not in the picture about the open door.
Well,
so what else? That they're sleeping?
Right. The four things that I mentioned, I think. you know, that nobody responded to the knock, that they're sleeping, that there's drugs in the open. This is...
You know, that response to the knock comes after they're already there. I mean, when they're going, when do you need to have these factors about community caretaking? Are they fluid? Does it depend on when they get there? Additional factors might come into play. I agree with that.
Sure. Yeah, and when they got there, I mean, what they did was they confirmed at least part of the tip about the open door, which is, like I say, a critical factor to what they do next, which is then to knock on the door. And then, given the information that they have about what is allegedly going on or reportedly going on inside, I mean, somebody was in that residence to have made that call. At least that's the inference from the...
You have to assume that because they can't see the people sleeping if they're standing at the door, the open door. They don't see the drugs. They don't see the people sleeping. Right. So they got to go in. So the tipster had to be in that apartment.
If that tip was...
So the tip really isn't corroborated by somebody having passed the door, right? So I'm not so sure there was corroboration.
Right, only the open door. And if they had, and this isn't in the record, but if they had known for some reason that this was the residence of Pinkard, and Pinkard is Big Boy, you know, that would have confirmed that the tipster knew who they were talking about. But
then you're talking probable cause.
And this is why I think there's difficulty here with being able to get a warrant. And I think they recognize that fact. But but you can't divorce this, I think, from their concern that this is somebody who could be in need of assistance.
Counsel, would this change your analysis at all? Facts the same as here. However, in a post-conviction hearing, long after the entry and the arrest and the finding of guilt, post-conviction hearing, the anonymous informant, it is shown that the anonymous informant had been in there, really was not happy with the defendant, walked out, left the door open, and then called the police and told them exactly what the facts here. Does that change your analysis at all?
No, it doesn't. It's kind of like if they had found somebody who was really in desperate need of help, or whether they didn't find it. That's the post after the fact. I mean, we look at this in terms of what was confronting them and what they did in response to that, not what any reason for whether the caller was making it up or that. I mean, all we know is what the officer knew based on the tip, and that's what you have to go on for that.
Mr. Frymuth, obviously you want us to affirm the Court of Appeals. Is there anything that you disagree with the Court of Appeals opinion, or anything that this court, if we were to go your way, should address that the Court of Appeals did not?
The only thing that I can think of is that threshold question about... I don't want to say the only thing. One of the things is a threshold question about applying community caretaker to residences. But understandably, the Court of Appeals didn't address that since it wasn't raised or complained. The defendant didn't raise it in the Court of Appeals. The other aspect that I'd have to look more closely at the Court of Appeals might be whether they accurately portrayed Kramer and the subjective, objective aspect of that. I think they did, but that would be the only other thing. I think at the end of the analysis, they maybe didn't elaborate to the same extent that I am attempting to do in my brief and here this morning, as far as the factors that go into play in the community caretaker analysis. That would be that, the other aspect of that.
What about the balancing test?
Right. That would be part of those four factors. And I can go into them if you would like, if that's what you're... There are the four factors. The first, this is from Kramer, the first is the degree of the public interest and exigency of the situation, and that's been... Pardon?
How do you characterize that?
Again, I think it's a twofold. It's a concern for that the occupants may be in need of some help, medically or otherwise, concern that there was a crime committed there, that there are victims of crime, concern that a third party might take advantage of the situation. I posed the example of a child coming into the residence and seeing that.
Did any of that on the record?
Not for the objective part. The subjective is a different story, what the officer subjectively...
So the court can just make that up?
Well, can consider the, right, the scenario that might happen.
I mean, it's an objective... The court invents this scenario.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Right. The second part of the test is the attendant circumstances, including time, location, degree of overt authority and force displayed. As I suggested, every step along the way, the officers acted reasonably in responding to an ambiguous situation, knocking on the heavy door, announcing their presence, waiting 30 to 45 seconds, entering when they received no response, proceeding directly to the bedroom in accordance with the tip, and again loudly announcing their presence, still eliciting no response. There was no ruse employed here to gain entry by the officers. Third is the balancing of the privacy interest, which I think here is reduced by the fact of the open door, at least compromised. It's not a closed, locked residence. It's an open door that raises a concern. And that pales in comparison to the concern about human life. I did cite cocaine statistics, and to the extent that I could find those online, the amount of drug use, unfortunately, is substantial in Wisconsin. And so the risk that somebody could be having a medical need as a result of cocaine overdose certainly is a valid concern.
So I'm of the belief that cocaine use is harmful to your health and sometimes exceedingly harmful to your health. Why? And my concern is that this case opens the door, so to speak, to a community caretaker anytime that there's a drug call, essentially.
I think the distinguishing factor here is it's not just, if this were just a call that somebody's in a residence sleeping amidst drugs in the open, that's not going to do it. Here, the open door is that other critical factor to this scenario. And the fact that the report is somebody sleeping, I don't think the officers necessarily have to take it face value either when you're talking about cocaine and drugs like that.
So it's the open door that saves this from a slippery slope. Hmm?
Right. And I don't think an open door by itself also is going to be good enough. I mean, I think you have to look, as the test is, the totality and those four critical facts that I suggested, not just the open door, but when they arrive and confirm it and knock on it and nobody responds to it, and you have allegedly or reportedly two people inside, neither of whom responds.
At least half of our cases that I see here, when there's a drug place and officers coming, it's at least 45 seconds, you know, before. So the idea that they knocked and 30 to 45 seconds passed and no one responded doesn't resonate with me because it's so common. Right? You know, sometimes they, you know, knock, knock, who's there? But not very often.
But I think the reason this is different from the concern that this is going to open the door to any kind of entree without a warrant to drug scenario is not true because of the open door and because of that, because of the nature of that call. So I think the facts of this case suggest to me at least, and it's, like I say, I think it's right on the cusp, that this isn't going to happen very often, that you're going to have this constellation of factors. But when you do have something like this, that police should be free to act, even where you've got that simultaneous concern that there may, or awareness that there may be law enforcement investigation or drug investigation concern as well.
No, the issue isn't whether police should be free to act if they think somebody's in trouble. That's not the issue here. The answer to that question is very easy. They should. The question here is whether they can use evidence that they find.
Right.
That's the question in this case.
Sure.
And what if the caller said that they're not asleep, they're awake, but the door's open, so be careful. Could they go in on an emergency?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Or on that?
No. Nope.
There's a child present in the house.
Probably not. I mean, if you have, everything else is the same, open door.
Everything's the same.
I still think if they're awake, no. I mean, I guess the concern
is... So the real kicker is their sleep.
That's one of the four, yep. Okay, I see my time is up.
Thank you. Mr. Frank. Mr. Zaffiro?
Thank you. I've got much more here, so before I jump into the
committee. Mr. Zaffiro, you're to start again, and please stand before the
get
mic.
Get back in front of the mic. I have a number of notes, and so I certainly can jump into those unless there's a question or two that immediately needs addressing here. Otherwise, I'll do that. The situation that was discussed, I think, in some of the questioning just now is exactly my fear here, too, that every single time we have drugs, which are dangerous, that's why they're illegal, that's why they're scheduled, that we're going to be able to go in. And the mere fact of an open door or someone sleeping, I mean, we're essentially saying we want to make a rule. This is the rule that it's being argued for. We're essentially saying we want to make a rule here where if you leave your door open and somebody, anybody, calls the police and says you're sleeping next to drugs, the police can go in. That can happen to me. It can happen to Big Boy. That can happen to you. That can happen to anybody. I don't think we want to go that far. I truly don't. Tipsters give tips for a variety of reasons, oftentimes in the gang rival world, because it is a gang rival. Was this a situation where the drugs were planted? Who knows? But in any event, look at the balancing test. You know, one of the things that I don't believe I spoke about when I did my initial argument here, the Court of Appeals decision never did the balancing test. It's just not there. So let's do that now. Looking at Section 41 of Cramer, the stronger the public need and the more minimal the intrusion, the more likely we're going to find the conduct reasonable. Now, I say that against the backdrop of my initially stated comments that this exception doesn't apply in a home case at all. But if you were to find that it does, on the one hand, we have in Cramer, the police have a substantial interest to assist motorists who may be stranded. No doubt about that. What interest do they have in assisting people sleeping in their own bed at 9 o'clock in the morning? I think there's a difference there. I think that factor favors Pinkert. Time, location, degree of force and authority displayed. In the case of Cramer, the court says at Section 43, it is hard to imagine Wagner displaying less overt authority on the one hand. On the other hand, here in Pinkert, five armed uniformed gang squad officers coming into your bedroom, shouting and shaking him awake at 9 o'clock in the morning. I think that factor favors Pinkert. Third, automobile. Well, clearly, this is not one. That factor favors Pinkert. Finally, what were the alternatives available? Actually, counsel pointed a couple of them out, I believe, from Zadonis. Bullhorns or air horns to rouse the people. That wasn't done here, along with the other alternatives that I cited in my argument. In a situation like Zadonis, where you have a nuisance, creating or maintaining that nuisance diminishes your expectation of privacy. Look, if you're pumping loud music at 3 in the morning is keeping your neighbors awake, you can't very well expect that someone's not going to come by and say, by the way, turn it down. Whereas in this situation, no such thing is happening. They sleep in their own bed, in their own home, at 9 o'clock in the morning. I think that factor favors Pinkert as well. The South Dakota case we just cited, I haven't seen it yet, and I assume that I'll be responding to that one when that is cited. But I did cite a North Dakota case, the Gill case, which said, and essentially what I'm trying to say here, the community caretaker exception does not allow you to go into someone's home to check on the people's welfare. North Dakota Supreme Court says that in Gill. In terms of whether this is an emergency aid case or not, I'm glad that the pronunciation help was granted. Bogus, I guess, is how that case is pronounced. Do we have reasonable grounds to believe that there was an immediate need to provide aid or assistance due to actual or threatened physical injury? No, we do not. Is immediate entry necessary with a reasonable expectation of privacy? Is the entry necessary to provide emergency aid or assistance? No, it's not. So, again, that goes by the way. Child wandering in, of course, that was not argued, that certainly was not testified to, but the alternative in that scenario is close the door, and then the child can't wander in. End of that issue. A disabled car investigation is different for the balancing test reasons that I've just set out here. The Fourth Amendment exists even if you're alleged to be a drug house. My time is up. If there's no other questions, thank you for your time. Otherwise, I'm ready to answer whatever questions there are. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Zaviro, and thank you, Mr. Franklin, for, again, arguing a search and seizure case, and so soon a caretaker case. That concludes our hearing on 08-AP-1204-CR, State versus Pinkert. The court will take a recess because in the next case, various exhibits are going to be displayed and they'll need some time for a setup. The court will be in recess and the marshal will advise when you're ready.